You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, introducing whiny-ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It is Tuesday, March 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, you know, based on our conversation yesterday with Matt Taibbi about the absolute failure, and more than absolute failure, the complete lack of will, the complete lack of institutional will of the SEC and the DOJ to prosecute Wall Street, effectively deregulating Wall Street in some respects, not providing any type of accountability for things like fraud, for things like endeavors that would rock the financial foundations of this country. We're going to have on the program Peter Mouget. He is a partner at Levin Papantonio. You'll recognize that firm, Mike Papantonio's firm down in Florida. Papantonio, of course, one of the hosts of Ring of Fire, of which I have recently joined, Bobby Kennedy Jr. And Mouget will talk to us about some of the civil litigation that's going on, because like I mentioned yesterday, when you have such regulatory capture by the industries that are regulatory agencies, and the DOJ in some respects is a regulatory agency, it upholds the laws, or theoretically should uphold the laws. The last vestige of any type of protection that the public has against complete corporate malfeasance are trial lawyers, plaintiff litigators, as they like to call them. So I call them trial lawyers. I don't care. I'm not embarrassed by it. I'm not one, but I do have almost a year of law school under my belt. In fact, an entire year, technically on sabbatical, 19 years later. Let's jump right into the news. The jobs picture, as reported yesterday, is improving slowly, hopefully surely. The latest job figures released by the federal government for February show that the economy added 192,000 jobs, helping drive the unemployment rate down to 8.9%. Now, you know that there has to be at least 140,000 jobs just to keep up with the growth of the population to have a net positive effect on employment. However, the share of the population in the labor force is at 64.2%. That's the lowest since 1984, which means that a lot of workers are simply on the sidelines. They are out of the system at this point. They are 99ers. They're not even seeking employment as far as the government is concerned. So they very well may be seeking employment, and they probably are in a lot of circumstances. This has to change. And hopefully they will find employment once the job market improves. But nevertheless, this is the first time the unemployment rate has fallen below 9% since April 2009. Of course, we know this is a Pyrrhic victory because of the austerity that all of our leaders in Washington seem hell-bent in imposing upon the vast majority of Americans. When we talk about austerity, we're only talking about poor people and middle-class people. When we talk about shared sacrifice, we're not talking about the top quintile of richest people in this country. They will not sacrifice. They will sacrifice nothing. And to the extent that they do, it won't be a sacrifice that that the government will make on their behalf. Maybe they'll just go out to the Hamptons for one less week this year. Or maybe it's just we'll have to go to Aspen instead of Stuttgart or wherever it is. Instead of the Swiss Alps. I know that certainly at our household, we have had to make that sacrifice. It's been just heartbreaking. Heartbreaking to announce it to my family that we will not be going to the Swiss Alps this year. But rather, we will have to go, well, we may not be going to Aspen. We may go to the Catskills. But I have no problem with that, actually. Catskills, very beautiful this time of year. And what is the clarion call for this austerity that we know is coming? And we are hearing about budget negotiations. Some of the corporatist Dems in the Democratic Party refuse to even deal with the cuts that Obama has proposed. It's not enough to simply cut food stamps. It's not enough to simply cut food for single mothers, their children, pregnant women. That's not enough. They're going to need more. And why? What is the cover for this? It is the constant refrain by both the Republicans and the neoliberals in our society that the country is broke. That we are dealing with a deficit and a debt that is completely unsustainable. We're going to crash any day now. The Chinese are going to adopt, the entire world's going to adopt the yuan. And our paper's going to be worthless. Folks, stock up on your heritage seeds and your gold bullion and your coins and your South Carolina currency. Because we're going broke, except for we're not. And except for we can't. Bloomberg News. Bloomberg News, that bastion of liberalism. David Lynch reports, House Speaker John Boehner routinely offers this diagnosis of the U.S. fiscal condition. We're broke. Broke going on bankrupt, he said in a February 28th speech in Nashville. Boehner's assessments dominates a debate over the federal budget that could lead to a government shutdown. It is a widely shared view with just one flaw. It is wrong. The U.S. government is not broke, said Mark Chandler, global head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman & Co. in New York. There's no evidence that the market is treating the U.S. government like it's broke. You see, a family can go broke. But here's the dirty little secret. A family is not like a massive government whose currency dominates the world. I know that's hard to wrap your brains around. It's just simply not the case. The U.S. today is able to borrow at historically low interest rates, paying 0.68% on a two-year note that it had to offer at a 5.1% before the financial crisis in 2007. What does that mean? If Evan comes to me and says, Sam, hey, can I borrow $2,000? I promise to pay you back in 12 months. Well, I know what Evan makes. And I know what Evan spends. And if I'm going to take that type of risk that Evan may not be able to pay me back, I'm only going to do it at a premium. So I would say to Evan, based upon your potential to pay this back, I'm going to charge you 30% interest. You know what? Actually, 40% would probably be more rational.
Thanks, Sam.
But if I know that Evan has another job where he's making $20,000 a month, $2,000, sure. Just give me, I don't know, a couple percentage points interest because I know he's going to pay it back. And then I have a sure investment. Additionally, tax revenue as a percentage of the economy is at a 60-year low. So that's not just a function of tax revenues down because we're in a recession, because it is a function of where we are in terms of the GDP. Meaning that if the government needs to raise cash, it can do so if there is political will. In other words, if there is a chance that rationality can overcome the incredible stranglehold the rich have on our government in this country. A person, company, or nation would be defined as broke if it couldn't pay its bills, and that is not the case with the United States. Despite an annual budget deficit expected to reach $1.6 trillion this year, the government continues to meet its financial obligations, and investors say there is little concern that will change. And if investors are saying that, that means that there will be a constant flow of money that we can have access to, not just from a revenue side, but also from a borrowing side to meet our obligations. Still, a rhetorical drumbeat has spread that the U.S. is tapped out. Republicans, including Ron Paul of Texas, Fox News commentator Bill O'Reilly, have labeled the U.S. broke in recent days. Chris Christie, Julian Robertson, even John Stewart. Financial markets dispute the political world's conclusion. The cost of insuring for 5 years a notional $10 million in U.S. government debt is $45,830. In other words, when people make a loan to someone that they're not sure is going to be paid back, and you never are sure, a lot of people go out and they'll get insurance to cover that. So for a $10 million loan to the U.S., you can insure that you will get paid back by a third-party insurance company for $45,000. That is less than the half the cost it was in February 2009 at the height of the crisis. And it also makes the U.S. government debt the fifth safest of 156 countries rated and less likely to suffer default than any major economy, including every member of the G20. On the other hand, creditors regard Venezuela, Greece. Remember, we hear so many times, we're turning America into Greece. It's going to be Greece. In fact, I think my first that's bullshit a year ago now was, we're not Greece. And Argentina are the three riskiest countries. Buying credit default insurance on a $10 million of those nations' debt cost $1,250,000, $665,000 respectively. Think about that. If you loan money to Venezuela, $10 million, it costs you $1,000,002 to insure that. If you loan $10 million to the U.S. government, it costs $45,000 to insure that. Every single person who buys a government bond, every single entity who buys a government bond, every single entity that insures the purchase of those bonds, which are just loans, would have to be completely out of their minds for it to be true that we are in danger of going broke. George Magnus, senior economic advisor for the UBS Investment Bank in London, says the U.S. dollar status of the global economy unit of account means the U.S. can't go broke. You have the reserve currency, Magnus said. You can print as much as you need, so there's no question all debts will be repaid. Is it good to have an ongoing debt spiraling out of control for decades and decades? No. It's inefficient. Is it catastrophic? No. Is it the biggest problem facing this country now? Absolutely not. Jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. In addition to accepting low yields on two-year notes, creditors are willing to lend the U.S. money for longer periods at interest rates that are below long-term average. 10-year U.S. bonds carry a rate of 3.5%, compared with an average of 5.4% since 1990. U.S. debt is more attractive than comparable securities from the U.K., which has moved aggressively to rein in government spending. In other words, their austerity measures, which are sold to provide confidence to the market, confidence to bondholders, their austerity measures are not working. They're sinking the economy, and they're not increasing their ability to get loans from bondholders, from bond buyers, unless they pay a higher interest rate back to those bondholders. You are never broke as long as there are those who will buy your debt and lend money to you, says Edward Altman, a finance professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. This is the reality, folks. And I want to remind you, measured against the size of the economy, the U.S. federal tax revenue is at its lowest level since 1950. Tax receipts in 2011 fiscal year are expected to equal 14.4% of GDP. That compares with a 40-year average of 18%, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Remember, I always harp on that report by that Cato guy, Nickerson, who was probably drummed out of the Cato Institute for reporting this. But when you have taxes below something like 18 or 19% of GDP, your government actually gets larger because people think they're getting a break on it. Just like when I try and explain to Nikki, it doesn't matter that it's on sale. You're spending more because you think you're getting it at a discount. So if tax receipts return to their long-term average amid an economic recovery, about one-third of the annual budget deficit would disappear like that. Even if you didn't raise taxes back up to historic levels, it would return like that if the economy bounces back, when the economy bounces back. Likewise, individual federal income tax rates have declined sharply since the top marginal rate peaked at 94% in 1945. 94% in 1945, the marginal rate, which applies to income above a numerical threshold, in other words, for every dollar you make over $500,000, $1 million, wherever we set it, was 91% as late as 1963 and 50% in 1986. For 2011, the top marginal rate is 35% on income over $373,000 for individuals and couples filing jointly. Americans also aren't overtaxed compared with the residents of other advanced nations. In a 28-nation survey, only Chile and Mexico reported a lower total tax burden than the U.S. Do any of you right-wingers want to move to Mexico? See how long you last down there in that narco state we have created? We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Peter Mouget about how individuals, via tort law, are holding Wall Street accountable for sinking our economy. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. On the phone, I have Peter Mouget. He is a partner at Levin Papantonio, of course, the law firm of Mike Papantonio. And following our conversation yesterday with Matt Taibbi about the Department of Justice and the SEC's failure to pursue any criminal action, any way of regulating the activity of Wall Street as they took down our financial system, I wanted to speak to somebody who was holding Wall Street to account via our civil courts. And Peter Mouget is one of those guys who are doing it. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, Peter, give me a sense of what type of actions are being pursued in civil courts to hold Wall Street accountable.
It's running the gamut. I mean, we saw a record number of filings last year, all the way from the securities cases, like the regular class type cases that are filed in federal court under federal securities laws, for misrepresentations in SEC filings, to derivative actions against officers and directors, a record number of securities arbitrations against Wall Street firms in their capacities as brokers. You're also seeing, I mean, with the wave of mortgage-related litigation cases being filed, the amount of litigation that's stemming out of this is absolutely incredible, which is quite frankly why I see, or we're all not seeing, a lot of DOJ action. I believe that the amount of litigation is just overwhelming the state and federal agencies, and then the complexity of the securities themselves are making it just a monumental Herculean effort. Resources a lot of them don't have, and the underlying securities business deals are so confusing, so complex, so esoteric. They're unregulated, like the derivatives market. Lack of transparency. It takes it would take a full-time 100-man law firm to look at pieces of these, and that's why I don't think you're seeing a lot of action on the criminal side or even the regulatory side. You're just not seeing. They just can't keep up with the wave.
All right, so let's break this down because I want to get to that question too. To what extent, what the role should be for criminal pursuits in this context? But talk to me about the nature of, you said, misrepresentations of security filings. Tell me about. Let's start there. What kind of misrepresentations are we seeing? What does that mean for a layperson?
They're understating. They're meaning the publicly traded companies are understating risk associated with their holdings, the way they state revenue. Let's take, for instance, Lehman Brothers. Everybody knows Lehman Brothers blew up in large part because of off-balance sheet deals. They couldn't get a United States law firm to say grace over how they wanted to structure some of their deals, shifting the liabilities off their balance sheet. So they got a European law firm to say grace over it. And
So what does that mean? So they're doing deals, they're buying certain things, they have liabilities essentially because they hold these bad assets, meaning some type of mortgage-backed securities
that's
worthless.
Right.
How do they put it off their books? I mean, what do they just decide, well, you know, let's leave that off, we don't have to tell anybody.
They literally will set up special purpose entities, and they will contort and twist, GAAP, whatever standards apply for whatever deal. They'll create what they call an SPE, special purpose entity, and they will literally shift the liability off of their books, repo agreements, you name it, anything to shift liability to make them look stronger, to make the revenues look better. You've got to beat the street estimates of the earnings per share. Whatever you're talking about, manipulation of Wall Street publicly traded company firms to make them look better than they are. Let's take another example.
So wait, let me see if I got this straight. So if I wanted to get some investors to invest in the Majority Report and I wanted to make it look like I was making money hand over fist and this is a great investment, but I didn't want to tell them that I was paying my two producers so much money that it actually cut into my profits, I'd set up another company that paid them that I would maybe, I guess, that I wouldn't have to put on my books. This other company is paying them, and I would occasionally get into deals with that other company that would fund them. Is that basically it?
Pretty much in a nutshell, that's it. I mean, shifting liabilities off the books of the publicly traded company is what it boils down to. And so what you see is they'll come out and make a good, they mean the Wall Street firms or publicly traded company will come out and make a corrective disclosure. And they'll say, oh, this is the way it really is, not what we said 6 months ago. And the plaintiff's firms will come out and they will file class suits capturing the decline in the stock price related to the corrective disclosure. And that's what the harm is under federal securities law to the investor. But there's different ways of attacking that. We represent a lot of investors individually, not in the class context. And your damages are kind of rescission-based damages, meaning give me my money back. So there are different ways to go after the same fraud, depending on what type of claim it is. But that's in a nutshell. When the firms come out on a corrective disclosure and they'll say, like an updated or amended SEC filing and spill the beans, so to speak, is when you see the class action complaints getting filed in large part.
I see. And in terms of the type of mortgage litigation we're seeing, tell me how that's breaking down, because my understanding is that this whole MERS thing, this automated system which allowed the transfer of mortgages over and over again without recording them with the local authorities that they were supposed to record them with, and have basically destroyed the chain of title for mortgages, has completely broken down, and this has left a lot of room for action against these companies that are like foreclosing on places, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't even think we've begun to see the tip of the iceberg in the wave of litigation that's going to come from the mortgage crisis. There is anything from MERS, which is all what we're seeing in the national press with the robo-signers. You are seeing publicly traded companies like LPS come out, which is the software that interfaces between the servicers and the law firms that foreclose, these network firms that were all part of this MERS network. And, I mean, that's a piece of litigation that I see, really getting some speed. There is going to be pieces of this mortgage or asset-backed security, litigation that I don't even think we've seen the beginning of it and will be years to come, from the civil side.
Do you have a sense of, and I know this deal has just been leaked, so I forgive me if you haven't quite digested it, but I know that there's a deal that's in the works with a lot of the state attorney generals to resolve some of this stuff and maybe start to force the cram down of principle. Have you seen any details on that deal?
I think if you go to the source of some of the AGs that are pushing those claims, I think they'll give you a different version of the world that they are ready to resolve those. I'm hearing two different things. One from the press that they're getting pressure and they're going to cave and settle, and others that's saying we're just getting started. So I'm not sure how much truth there is to some of the stories that are leaking, and some of the AGs are beating the drum to make it sound like they're in it for the long haul. So I'm not quite sure that's the, that's what's really going on at this point.
Do you have a sense of how much money is involved in these class action suits, these individual suits across the country in the wake of this financial crisis? How much
trillions? Trillions. I think the amount of money is staggering. The amount of problems in the way the system was set up with taking mortgages for people who could never afford to pay them back, whether they were subprime, Alt-A, however you want to frame the loans, they were packaged and sold to be securitized. They were put in anything from mutual funds. They were sold to our pension plans. And the end of the day, the problem with this whole setup, the way, is the lack of accountability for Wall Street firms, for banks. I mean, they're lending money to folks that can't afford to pay it back, and they don't care. Why? Because the mortgages don't stay on their books. So they're taking the mortgages. They're selling them to a Wall Street firm. It's packaging them up and securitizing them. Do they care? No, because they're selling them. They split these things into tranches. They create the derivatives. They split them up. The Wall Street firms keep the super senior tranches. They take the high risk, low level, toxic trash, and they sell it to Main Street through pension funds, through mutual funds, and nobody understood what they were buying. And I mean, one, they call them a PPM, a private placement memorandum. This stuff is being sold to pension funds across the country, mom and pops through mutual funds. You're talking about 300 or 400 pages explaining one deal. And it's not uncommon that mutual funds will own hundreds of them. So you're talking 30, 40,000 pages of disclosures. Nobody understood what they own. In the pension funds, it's an absolute mess. And I think it's just getting started.
Is there liability? I mean, the fact that the system was set up in such a way that the people who would make these loans, offer these loans, and then basically just turn around and sell them, is there any type of liability that they have as lenders? I mean, is there any type of regulation that says you as a loaning agent have some type of fiduciary responsibility to someone somewhere that they could be held liable for?
I think it depends in what context. A lot of the representations about the loans, the documentation on the loans, how complete it was, how authentic the documentations were, I think that's definitely going to be a piece that the initial lenders have culpability on. Mm-hmm. And you go all the way up and down the food chain, and there's problems everywhere. And that's, I think that's why I keep saying that the litigation is just getting started, because at first the most of the litigation focused on a little bit further up the food chain, like for instance where the mortgages were packaged, securitized, and then sold. The folks that bought them is where the litigation started, and the losses started mounting in late 07, 2008, and I think that's where you saw it first. But I believe that you're going to see more litigation up and down that waterfall or that food stream up and down all the way back down to the banks.
So as one person holds the person they bought it from liable, that person turns around and holds the person they bought it from liable.
That's exactly right. You're seeing this even in the litigation that's outstanding, parties being added to the initial complaint up and down the food stream, everybody pointing the finger at somebody else.
And so finally, let me just so this notion that you think that these regulatory agencies and the Department of Justice are just they're overwhelmed. What is the relationship? I mean, would it be helpful for civil cases if there were some more or some any high profile legal charges or convictions or indictments made to just sort of establish some type of baseline?
It would, but this is the way it's historically been. The people running point on these aren't typically the regulators. They're undermanned. As we're seeing right now with the SEC and Dodd-Frank, we can't even get the budget passed to fund the studies, the Dodd-Frank mandates. So you've got right now you've got private attorney generals through plaintiffs litigators that are pushing the litigation and are out in front, and there are a minority, very minority of cases the regulators are teeing up and moving on, but they are way behind, and it's typically because they're underfunded, they're undermanned, and they don't the people they have in place on these esoteric products, they just don't have the folks in place that understand what the underlying product is.
Well,
we've never seen this type of litigation in this magnitude with this complexity. It's you know, did Cisco or did WorldCom or Enron, you had the accounting deals that we saw over the last decade, but this wave of litigation with all of the derivatives is one of the most complex structured finance type deals, and the regulators are having a terrible time getting their arms around it.
Well, Peter Mouget, partner at Levin Papantonio, thank you very much for joining us. It is just another example how I say that you guys, trial lawyers or plaintiff litigators is the PC term, how you guys are our last bastion at a time where we have such type of regulatory capture.
Thanks, Sam.
Appreciate you coming on.
Have a good day.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Come back. Still a couple more minutes of the free podcast, the daily free podcast. I give. Take. We'll be right back. All right, folks, just one more example. There's simply a class war going on here, and any means in which the rich and the financiers can be held to account. You notice that, you know, Mouget started off talking about how Lehman Brothers couldn't get any U.S. attorneys to sign off on what they were doing. And it wasn't just the idea or the notion that they were afraid of criminal prosecutions. They're afraid of trial lawyers coming after them because on behalf of plaintiffs who were getting ripped off. And so they had to get European attorneys to sign off on them. And this is, you know, this is what I say all the time. I mean, you know, particularly through the Bush administration, but in many respects, even under this administration, particularly when we have the Republicans hell-bent on destroying entities like the EPA to the extent that the EPA is effective, the only other way to curb the behavior of corporations is the constant, never-ending threat that when they make that economic opportunity cost calculation in their boardroom, how much will we have to pay if we don't recall that car that blows up and kills a couple of people? How much will we have to pay? Is it more than actually fixing that problem? And if the answer is yes, they will fix the problem. If the answer is no, they won't fix the problem. That's it. That's the calculation. There's no like, well, wait a second. There's people in that car that could die. They have a family. No. Each one of those people that they anticipate would die in that accident because the back of the car will blow up has a dollar figure attached to them. That dollar figure is a function of how hard trial lawyers go after these companies for hurting consumers, hurting workers. At this point, the consumers are investors and pension funds and across the board, those of us who had some type of stake in the financial stability of this country. And of course, the other way that we gain protection, we gain political and economic power in this country, if we are not a multimillionaire, is through unions. Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, Hacker was on this show very early on in his talking about his book, Winner Take All Politics. I would recommend you go back and check that out. You can always find it at the searchmajority.fm. He talks about how organized labor was on the front lines during the struggle for universal health care, for the fight of Medicare for the aged. They were the main champions of organizing rights for workers and of the gradual transformation of Social Security into a strong foundation for a dignified retirement. Unions even lent, he's talking about the political power of unions here. He's talking about what is going on in this country when they attack unions. It has nothing to do with budgets. It has to do with stripping working people. Not just, you know, 60-70% of the country of their political power, of one of their sources of political power. Unions lent crucial support to the civil rights movement, leading one congressional champion, Missouri Democrat Richard Boling, to later observe, "We would have never passed the Civil Rights Act without labor. They had the muscle, the other civil rights groups did not." Decades of research have shown that the economic pyramid is flatter in countries where unions are stronger. In other words, there's less financial disparity, less income disparity. In economies as different as Canada and Germany, a sturdy union presence has helped reduce income inequality. The reason isn't just that unions defend their members. They also create changes in social norms, such as pressures for non-union employers to match union gains. Recent study by the sociologists Bruce Western and Jake Rosenfeld suggests that including these indirect effects Labor's decline may account for as much as a third of the rise in American wage inequality since the 1970s. At least a third, probably the other two-thirds, would be tax policy in this country. Unions also push for broad federal policies that reduce gaps in income and wealth. They have been one of the few organized voices that have consistently pressed back against a string of tax cut bills for the rich that began in the late 1970s. Meanwhile, groups representing the affluent have only grown stronger. In the early 1970s, corporations organized on an unprecedented scale to reshape policy and debate. Almost overnight, they expanded their already formidable presence in Washington, forging bonds with wealthy donors promoting business-friendly ideas. This emboldened conservatives while creating powerful conflicts for a Democratic Party increasingly torn between corporate money and its historical electoral connection to the little guy. In more than a generation, the richest 0.1%, 0.1%, one-tenth of 1%, 0.1% of taxpayers saw their slice of the national income, including capital gains, increase from less than 3% to more than 12%. You understand that one-tenth of 1% controls 12% of the money in this country. Perhaps the most destructive legacy was the expansion of the reckless practices on Wall Street. And he goes on to say that some unions have problems. Unions have problems, and I would agree with that. He writes, they've been much slower to change undesirable features of union contracts, such as policies that overemphasize seniority and protect poorly performing workers. Still, just as we wouldn't block entrepreneurs from forming corporations because some firms pollute or engage in financial fraud, we should not radically undermine the rights of Americans and unions just because some hinder effective response to economic and policy challenges. Do some union practices need reform? Yes, like every single thing else in the world. Except for God.
God's perfect. He'll take care of all of us.
And I do mean he. That God. So meanwhile, not only is there attacks on unions in the states, the Republican is pushing an anti-labor bill through Congress at the moment. House Transportation John Mica, this is reported by Joshua Holland at Alternet. He is a major recipient of campaign contributions from the airline industry. According to HuffPo, the provision he's pushing, if an eligible voter fails to vote for union representation, he or she will be tallied as an active vote against representation. In other words, I didn't vote that day. I was sick. I didn't come into work. I didn't get a chance to vote. Okay, well, then you're voting against it. This existed up until last July when the Federal National Mediation Board, which adjudicates labor management disputes, ruled that absent votes ought not to be counted against unionization. It's one of the few labor victories we've had in years. And, of course, the Republicans want to turn that back. Let me just give you a notion of what we're facing in this country in terms of rich versus poor. Report finds that 20% of Californians struggled to feed their families in 2010. Just over 20% of California respondents answered yes to the question, have there been times in the past 12 months when you didn't have enough money to buy food that you or your family needed? That places the state at number 16 in the nation for food hardship. The highest rate was recorded in Mississippi, where nearly 28% that said they did not always have enough money to buy food. The lowest rate, just over 10%, was in North Dakota. 60 Minutes did a piece on, from Florida?
Yes.
Some kids in Florida going to school. This is a devastating piece, and we'll link to it on the blog at Majority FM. Avant will get it in the roundup. Maybe we'll put it on the Tumblr site. I'm going to play you two clips. This is just incredibly heartbreaking. This is before austerity measures that are not only going to destroy our economy even more, not only going to reduce jobs in this country, but are going to cut away to the bone the safety net for kids like this. Let's play the intro from this first.
Unemployment improved a bit last month, but it's still nearly 9%. And the trouble is, job creation is so slow, it will be years before we get back the 7.5 million jobs lost in the Great Recession. American families have been falling out of the middle class in record numbers. The combination of lost jobs and millions of foreclosures means a lot of folks are homeless and hungry for the first time in their lives. One of the consequences of the recession that you don't hear much about is the record number of children descending into poverty. The government considers a family of four to be impoverished if they take in less than $22,000 a year. Based on that standard and government projections of unemployment, it is estimated the poverty rate for kids in this country will soon hit 25%. Those children would be the largest American generation to be raised in hard times since the Great Depression.
Do you remember, I think there was some time ago, I referenced an article that I found, I think through John Walker at Fire Dog Lake. I think it was in Steep Magazine. I'm not sure. STEEP. And it was a study that was done, I think, by Harvard researchers, which they had tested lab rats. And they tried to measure the implications of stress for young rats. And one of the most stressful things that a rat apparently can go through when they're a child is to be separated from their mother. And they found that in these tests, in separating them from the mother, that not only did these young rats suffer tremendous stress at that moment, but their brains developed in such a way that they had an incapacity to deal with stress as they got older. The scars from that stress at that age affected them for the rest of their lives. It made them less able to deal with situations as they got older. I want you to contemplate when you hear the next clip from that 60 Minutes. This is when Scott Pelley sits down with the class of 25 kids and starts asking them, how many of you have gone to bed hungry? Something like 80% of the kids raise their hand. These are this is a clip that they played of the kids discussing their situation. This is pretty heartbreaking.
It's like hard, you can't sleep, you just like wait, you just go to sleep for like 5 minutes and you wake up again and your like stomach hurts and you're thinking, I can't sleep, I'm going to try and sleep, but you can't because like your stomach's hurting and it's because it doesn't have any food in it.
And it's like a black hole. And sometimes when I don't eat my stomach, you can hear like it's like growling, you can hear it.
Usually we eat macaroni or we drink water or tea.
My mom will sometimes like make food and then she won't have enough, so at night we'll just eat cereal or something. Other times my parents will fight about money because they don't have enough money to pay the food.
We have to sometimes take food from a church. It's hard because my grandmother's also out of work and we usually get some food from her.
It's kind of embarrassing because the next day you go to school asking kids if they want this or if they want that. If they have cereal and they haven't opened it yet, you go ask them if they want their cereal.
And yet in this country, the debate is about how much money are we going to cut from programs that feed these kids. Not whether or not we're going to, how much. This country is not broke. This country is in no danger of going broke. And yet, to finance the tax cuts for millionaires, we are raising a generation of kids, 25%, living in poverty. And shitheads like Alan Simpson had the audacity to tell us this is about our grandkids. I tweeted out a chart breakdown. Programs at risk for these budget cuts versus tax breaks for the wealthy. $11.2 billion from early childhood programs. $11.5 billion, the per-year cost of recent tax cuts for millionaires' estates. $8.9 billion, low-income housing programs. $8.9 billion, cost of allowing mortgage interest deduction for vacation homes. $7.6 billion, supplemental nutrition for poor families, otherwise known as WIC. Pregnant women. $6.7 billion, the cost of estate planning techniques used by wealthy to avoid taxes. $4.6 billion, teacher training and after-school programs. $5.2 billion, the cost of removing limit on itemized deduction for high-income taxpayers for the year 2011. $4.1 billion, job training for unemployed workers and new workers. $4.1 billion, cost of tax breaks for offshore operations of U.S. financial companies. $2.5 billion, low-income energy assistance grants to poor families. $2.5 billion, tax breaks for oil companies. Those are write-offs for drilling and oil well costs in the fiscal year 2012. $2.5 billion, community health centers. $4.9 billion, the cost of extending alcohol fuel tax breaks. $0 billion homeless assistance grants, $2.3 billion tax loophole for managers of hedge funds and private equity funds in the fiscal year 2012, $420 million legal services for the poor, $312 million the cost of allowing companies to write off punitive damages over the course of 10 years, $317 million the Title X family planning. $303 million cost of special tax breaks for timber industry. $44 billion. All programs at risk combined. $42 billion is the one-year cost of extending the Bush tax cuts for the top brackets in fiscal year 2012.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, oddlay, oddlay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, oddlay, oddlow.
All right, folks. That's all I got for you today.
A prince on the bridge of a castle moat.
Can meet me on the other side, the flip side, as it were. I am me at Majority FM. I'm going to try and get Andy Kindler on this week to lighten it up a little bit. And hopefully tomorrow I will be sharing with you an interview that I intend to do later today of the director of Wasteland, an amazing film that was nominated for an Academy Award documentary. Chris Hayes will be on the program Thursday to discuss why Washington doesn't care about jobs. Don't forget, you can buy some coffee at justcoffee.coop. You can help us out by donating your Twitter account at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. And every purchase you make through that Amazon link keeps this show going. All right, see you on the flip side, folks. Hey, folks, as I always say, your membership is the only thing that will ensure we can keep doing this show. So please, if you can, join today at majority.fm. Not only will you support the show, you'll get an extra 50 minutes of the show every day, plus all sorts of other membership goodies.
But if you can't become a member, you can still support the show in other ways by virtually doing nothing. Head to Majority.fm, find the Majority FM Amazon.com graphic, click on it, bookmark it, buy goods from Amazon as you normally would, and you'll actually be redistributing wealth from a corporate behemoth to the independent media you listen to daily. That means me. It's simple, and it really helps. So please, if you can do it, do it. And you can also donate your Twitter account for one retweet daily at Majority.fm. Thanks.